And you mentioned one quick thing, which I want to ask you about. This is like kind of off the way we usually ask questions, but you mentioned, you know, you read one thing at a certain time in your life and then you read it again and it's like kind of irrelevant. So what books for you both have died and what books are still relevant?
If you were an animal.
Well, I can tell you what died, the Whole Earth catalog. I mean, that's toast. I got to tell you, I loved it. I would read everything. You know, I think, what's that for? Gone. It's dead to me now. Wow. you didn't see that coming, did you?
No. I'm gonna answer it actually not with a book but with a movie.
Okay.
So at the age of 18, I watched Rebel Without a Cause, and it was like the greatest thing ever. James Dean was I could feel his angst. It was just wow. And when I was about 32 and had a kid, I watched it again, and I got to the end of the movie, and I was like, what an idiot. You know, suddenly, like, you know, at 18, I thought, his parents are such jerks. and then at 32, I'm like, I'm with them. Yeah. Dude, you're grounded.
And this leads to this other question of kind of like the importance of the humanities in education in a strange way, because, you know, you look around and you see like what is possible, what are the careers that are possible, and you see people really making it happen in the tech industry or in business or as entrepreneurs. And what might get lost in that is the importance of kind of learning, you know, and the importance of the humanities. And I know that you've done a lot of work with the Human Dimensions of Organization program on that, but maybe just speak to like the importance of humanities in education.
I mean, the humanities have all sorts of profound influences, and I don't think I think we could do a whole show just on that, and we're not going to. So let's pick a particular thing. But I think one element that's extraordinarily important is human beings have a remarkable capacity to project themselves into all sorts of situations that they're not in at the moment, right? And so,
like right now,
I
wish I was watching the debates.
Yeah. And so, you know, when you read about a period in history, suddenly you can feel what it might have been like to be in revolutionary era France or in Rome, you know, and to take on the mantle of what would it have been like to be in that situation, or to read a piece of literature and identify with somebody who is very different from you and grew up in very different circumstances. And that has two big influences. The first is to help you to appreciate the degree to which other people are different from you, and to then bring that to your interactions with other people. But the other is to help you to recognize how much your experience in life so far is limited, and that by allowing yourself to continue to experience new things, your life narrative can be driven in different ways that you didn't imagine already. And I think that by immersing yourself in the humanities, it opens up a lot of new opportunities for you.
You know, it's interesting because I think this question goes beyond just a university education and goes to primary and secondary education as well, right? And I understand the desire to prepare people to do well in life, but that desire is overly optimistic about the linearity of the preparation. You know, we test the hell out of people in the school with the idea in mind, if we teach people to do a particular thing on a particular test, then they will be well prepared to confront whatever things they confront, you know, subsequent to schooling. And
because the test writers are sure what you're going to face in the rest of your life.
Exactly, right? But one of the things that's interesting about this to me is that, you know, people do want evidence that things are valuable. And what's interesting about using testing as that measure, whether it's in primary and secondary school or in higher education or whatever it happens to be. We said, well, you know we can get people to do better on tests because we're giving them tests, and that will motivate them to do better on tests, and then we'll see from their test scores that they did better on the test. And one of the basic things you learn in experimental science is the independent variable and the dependent measure can't be the same thing, right? So if you say we're going to give people tests, and then we're going to demonstrate how well they did by how well they do on the tests, and that will show that the test got them to do better on the tests, well, you see the circularity of that argument. That doesn't make sense.
You could be talking about brain games.
Anyway, we are talking about brain games, which is a chapter in Brain Briefs. Anyway.
Let me read it. That's don't right. play them.
But I think the interesting thing about this is that everybody I know who is really successful, I mean really successful, are broadly knowledgeable people. I mean, there are very few. There are a few, but very few, who are narrowly educated, who know a lot about a very few things, and that's the way they function. And so the idea about the humanities, you know, we talk about perspective gaining and that kind of thing and why those things are important. But one of the things that we undervalue is how much our brains work without our focusing on a particular thing. I mean, all of us have experienced falling asleep with a knotty problem on our minds and waking up with a solution. Now, what the hell happened there? How did that happen? I mean, we weren't thinking about it. We were unconscious, for God's sake. How did that happen? And the reason that happened is there are parts of our brain that are at work all the time, awake and asleep, that are operating below our conscious awareness. Now, if we think I've got this problem I need to solve, and all I need to do is focus only on this problem, and just keep focusing on that problem, and the problem will be solved, we have all kinds of experimental evidence that that's not the way things work.
And actually, I mean, just to amplify on that, right? If you look at the history of invention and innovation and great, you know, great discoveries, almost always those great, some of them are dumb luck, right? But most of the time, great discoveries involve people drawing analogies between one area of their knowledge and another. And the beauty of all of those stories is you had no idea in advance that that piece of knowledge was going to be important. So, you know, James Dyson developed the Dyson vacuum based on his knowledge about sawmills. And when he went and learned about sawmills, he wasn't thinking, better mark this down. This is going to be the idea that propels me to a $400 million a year company, right? He just learned it. Right? Along with a whole bunch of other things that aren't newsworthy because they didn't lead to a huge invention. But it is that preparation, that broad base of knowledge, that's the thing that allows you to then solve whatever problem comes your way. And one of the things I think is really important is, you know, we were telling stories about our lives. And the thing is, a story about your life is only clear in retrospect. Right? When you're moving forward, everything is chaos. Like, what are you going to do now? I have no idea. I'm going to do this thing. And then what's going to happen from that? I don't know. Right? You know, and then Rebecca came to the two of us at one point and said, you guys want to do a show? And we were like, okay. Right? And we'd love to say at that moment we knew. But we didn't know. You know, but then things came out okay. And so in retrospect, we look back and we go, oh, that was a pivotal moment. But you don't know. You don't know those things until well after they happen, which means that the willingness to read something, to engage with something, to learn something that where you didn't think it had any practical value in that moment is actually extraordinarily important. And those people who do that on a regular basis end up leading really interesting lives and doing really interesting things.
You know, it's interesting because I needed a retort for young students who would come to my class and would be working on some problem. And they'd say, well, when are we ever going to use this? You know? And I thought of a retort that I like a lot. So someone said, Dr. Duke, when are you ever going to use this? So I said, did you go to a movie last week? I said, well, yeah, I did, actually. I said, when are you ever going to use that? Now, the reason I say that, not because I like it because it's really clever, but that's why you like it. But I think more importantly, it is we sort of have this mistaken notion that we know what's going to be valuable. And if we line everything up correctly, then we'll get to some successful conclusion. And life is a mess. It's not linear. It's not clear at the outset. And so many students who come to the university and think, well, you know, I want to be a business major, and I have to take this biology class. Why do I have to take a biology class for? Well, because intelligent thinking human beings know a little bit about biology, right? Now, that seems like, you know, ivory tower mumbo jumbo, but it's not actually. You know, if you think about all the things that we confront in life in a contemporary society, I mean, we make all kinds of decisions about medical care. We do all kinds of things that to not understand anything about how any of that works and just say, look, I don't know, you know, is not a good place to be. And I want to say, too, it's not a good place for a society to be, right? If we cede the responsibility of decision making to other people who we say, well, I can't understand this, I have to just trust these other people who study this. Well, then I would argue that whatever experts, you know, have the loudest voice become the people that get listened to. And that's not a good strategy.
What would happen if someone ran for president and had no idea what they were talking about? How would anyone know?
How would you know?
Hypothetically speaking. Okay.
Thank you. Good night, everybody.
We talk about a lot, which I think is really interesting, which is like, you know, the things that we're attracted to them because we know them, you know, we are familiar with them. And I think we sometimes fool ourselves into thinking that we're attracted to things, you know, based on their value and what they kind of intrinsically have. But that same kind of like the way advertising works, which is we are attracted to things because we've seen them before and they're repetitious, also goes to academic. It's a new book. Well, see, everybody here is just interested in life, so we're kind of preaching to the choir a little bit, you know. But it's funny to think about, like, intellectually, what we're attracted to and why. And so you may, like, I look through podcasts all the time, and I'm thinking, like, what do I want to listen to on my run today? And there may be a conversation between two poets I've never heard of in my life, and I'm like, you know what? I don't care. I'm going to listen anyway. And I listen, and it's like incredible, you know? I mean, this incredible conversation I never would have listened to, and I wouldn't have necessarily searched for, and it wouldn't come up in something that is an algorithm for what I like because it's not, you know, part of my assessment of content. But, you know, how can we kind of tell ourselves, listen anyway, you know, look anyway, read it anyway, even though you're not necessarily attracted to it?
Well, I think there are a couple of issues to talk about. That's a great question, by the way. Part of it is, you know, we're busy. And I don't know if I'm always in a frame of mind when I'm ready to be challenged or I'm ready to experiment. You know, I mean, I think I'm tired. I want something I know what it's going to be like. You know, it's like intellectual meatloaf. You know, it's like, great. I know it's great. You know, I'm going to have this meatloaf and it's just great. And I don't want to be challenged. You know, I don't want some new Thai fusion thing now. I just don't want to go there, you know? So I think part of it has to do with picking your moments, right? I mean, I think, you know, a lot of people, I think, are in the unfortunate circumstance where they live their lives in stress alternating with exhaustion. And, like, that's it, you know?
But I think we also misestimate what we're going to enjoy,
yeah, exactly,
even when we're exhausted.
Sure.
And I think that's important, right? I mean, we talked on the show about this study about commutes. Right. And, you know, so they caught a bunch of people in Chicago getting on the bus or the train. And they would say to people in advance, if you had a conversation with somebody on the bus or the train, how would that be? And everybody would be like, oh, like some like a random person, a conversation. Are you kidding me? How? That's going to be awful. That's, you know, I just, and I wouldn't be productive. And then they would assign, randomly assign, some people have your normal commute. Some people, I want you to have a conversation, a random conversation with somebody on the bus or train. And people who had a random conversation loved it. I mean, on average, not just liked it, they loved it. It was like the best commute ever. They found this person who also knows about that movie that they saw that no one else has seen or whatever it is. They had this great conversation and they totally had no idea that that was going to happen. And I think one of the things that happens is when we're unfamiliar with something and we don't know what to predict, we assume the worst. This is going to suck. I'm going to get in a conversation. That person's going to try and be mean to me or pick me up or do something really disgusting. And I'm just, it's going to be awful and embarrassing.
What's happened to you? I'm just worried about you now.
But everyone does that. And so, don't they? No. And so what we do is we talk ourselves out of experiences that actually would have been great. And I think that that's a part of it. Even when you're exhausted, it might have actually been energized. You know, that veggie loaf that you would have had was, it would have been okay, but you had no idea what you might have been able to experience if you'd opened yourself up to this new thing. And I think we don't like uncertainty. We don't like situations in which we don't know what's going to happen. And so we avoid them, even though we are talking ourselves out of really experiences that could have been marvelous.
And I think in order to make that go, in order to make that a happy thing, we have to recognize going in that some of the experiments we're going to run are not going to be very happy. You know what I mean? Because I think, you know, there's a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy here, right? So I start the conversation with the person on the airplane, and good God, this is the most boring human being I've ever been around. And so I think never again. But I think, you know, we can set that up. And we say, you know what? You do five of those and then decide. And you may find that the first one sucked, but the next four were delightful. And now you think, well, my God, this is a pretty good odds of having a
They get off the plane going, never again.
Yeah, that's what they say a lot when I get off the plane. But I think that kind of thing, you know, setting yourself up so you think, you know what, I'm not expecting a guaranteed positive outcome, but I'm willing to take a chance that probabilities are that more often than not, it's going to be a positive thing.
And I think, too, we underestimate the value of that on our brain as we age. You know, these new experiences and creating these new pathways and these new memories. I mean, that's something that we talk about a lot in keeping your brain kind of young and healthy. That's an important thing.
Yeah, I mean, your brain is a prediction engine. And if you live only in a very familiar circumstance, your brain spends all of your days going, seen that, seen that, seen that. And then there's nothing to learn, right? And there's nothing interesting. And at that point, years race by. What happened in the last 20 years? Yeah, not much, right? And so one of the great advantages of trying new stuff, whether it's having a conversation with new people or waking up one day and deciding to take up a new musical instrument or doing a radio show or whatever it is that it creates these opportunities where your brain goes, huh? What's happening here? And that's actually good for your brain, right? It's really good for your brain doesn't like it. Your brain wants to minimize the amount of energy it spends on things, so it's going to keep guiding you back towards things that are familiar and comfortable. But actually, all of those experiences in which you go, huh, what? Those are great. Your brain learns a tremendous amount, and it brings more of that into your sphere of experience.
And it's sort of an interesting thing what evolution has done for the things that we find attractive and the things that are beneficial. I mean, one of the things that I think a lot of our students would like to imagine is that if you have a really good teacher, then learning is easy. And what Art and I say to our students often, if learning is easy, you're probably not learning very much. Because learning requires effort, right? Because actually, when we make anything happen that affects our brain in a lasting way, energy is expended. I mean, brains have to grow new stuff. I mean, organic memories don't work like computer memories. I mean, when you hit the save command on your computer looks for a blank space on the drive, writes what you want to save, which means binary switches flip from 1 to 0, 0 to 1 in some configuration that represents what you saved, puts an address on it. What was on the drive before has nothing to do with what you just put there, barring some malfunction. What you put on the drive subsequent to that has nothing to do with what you put there, barring some malfunction. Organic brains don't work anything like that, right? Each of you right now in this room is experiencing right now differently from the person sitting next to you. Not because you're in a different physical position and have a different visual perspective, different auditory perspective, but because all of you came into the room tonight with a different set of memories in your head. And what your brains are trying to do right now is your brain's memories are being activated by things that are happening right now. And because you have different memories already in your head, now is different than now is for the person sitting next to you. Now, if you think about that in terms of what Art's talking about, right, and you're trying to create experiences that make your life more interesting and make your brain more active, well, then it's understandable that the more you put yourself in situations that require intellectual effort, attentional effort, emotional effort, well, then your brain is now engaged in activities that actually prolong its health and prolong the extent to which you're able to access the things that you've been putting in all your life.
Which is way better than brain games. So we literally have a chapter in the book that's titled, Should You Play Brain Games? And the chapter starts out by saying just a one full page, and all it says is no. But a lot of it has to do with exactly what Bob was just saying, which is that it is our ability to challenge ourselves by learning new things, by interacting with new people. That's what creates all those new pathways. If you look at the data, the people who have the most education take the longest in life before they show signs of dementia in the case that their brains begin to deteriorate. So not everyone will show signs of dementia, but if your brain happens to be deteriorating, you actually need more deterioration to show a particular level of deficiency the more education you've had. Not because the brain cells themselves are protected, but because the more different ways that you have learned to look at problems and to retrieve information and to play with the knowledge you have, the more damage that's required before you are debilitated in some way. And so really, you know, exposing yourself to lots and lots of different ways of doing things is beneficial in huge numbers of ways, partially because you will act in a more agile way throughout your life, and partially because even if you end up experiencing some organic brain deterioration, you'll actually be protected to some degree from that.
And you know, can I just make one generalization about what we're doing right now, right? I mean, all of you, by the way, we're very grateful you came out tonight. Thank you for coming. But, you know, I mean, this is what you're doing right now is pretty passive, right? I mean, you're listening or feigning attention or whatever you're doing.
There is a faint murmur in the crowd. Sorry,
yeah. But you're not very active right now. The extent to which this experience becomes something meaningful to you and a meaningful part of your memory depends on what happens after you leave the room, right? When you talk to other people about this, or you recall it tomorrow and think about, what's that one thing about trying something new? And so it's that recalling and engaging with other people and calling the memory back up. That's when the learning part starts, right? I mean, unfortunately, at institutions of higher learning, like the University of Texas at Austin, we set up classrooms just like this, right? With bunch of people sitting in chairs, facing people, talking to them. And imagine that this is a learning environment. This is a terrible learning environment. Yet we're so convinced about that at University of Texas, in classrooms, we actually bolt the chairs to the floor, right?
With the idea, the students to the chairs.
Yeah, the students, we would if we could do that, right? But the idea in mind is that, you know, listening to people, watching things happen, is the way that you actually learn. And that's not the way you learn.
In fact, we want to take classrooms and put some of them in people's rooms with their computer screen and just let them watch that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how much we believe.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, what's interesting about this and all things that Art's saying about creating new experiences, right, is that it requires your brain to devote attention and devote energy to navigating the world. I mean, when you're tired, you know, we all get to that point. Look, I don't want anything new. I just want to sit here, have my meatloaf. You can tell I haven't had dinner tonight yet. I just want to do that because I know what's coming, right? But the idea is that when we create life experiences, which is why I think we feel so privileged about what we do. I mean, I seldom have 2 days that are alike. I mean, every day something happens that I need to respond to or react to or plan for or something. And so the experiences that I have are now forcing me to work intellectually harder and emotionally harder, I would say too, than I would if I could predict everything that's going to happen. And the more, again, those of us in a privileged society can create circumstances where we have more things to deal with, not negative things necessarily, but just things that require our attention, we create a different kind of health in terms of the way our brains function.
Which I think is a great place to open up questions, because then we can actually engage and interact and do all of those wonderful
Lovely.
Things you're talking about.
And so the queen of segue,
there we
thank
go.
You very much.
So Jack is going to come around with a microphone and just raise your hands if you have questions.